Man, okay. So I am completely overcome with emotion. Thank you, worship team, for always leading us to God. But so essentially last week, Edward was saying how much he loves a cappella over and over. And I was telling Mark, and so then when we saw it on the order of service today, Edward stayed out from class to be able to sing the song. And while we're singing the song that I too love so much, and these lines, right? Brother to brother, sister to sister, soul to soul. And this sweet little 5-year-old boy is clutching on and singing in my ear. I am losing it. And so deeply overwhelmed by God's providence, by the way that He takes care of us. Generation to generation, by the way that he puts us in family. The psalmist writes that the God sets the lonely in family, and what we have here is a beautiful, precious thing. So, forgive me while I manage. I guess these three devices to preach this today. We're going to be talking and continuing in our By Faith series. And obviously now, right, we've reached the point that we are in the appendix section of Hebrews 11, the I don't even have time to talk about all this stuff section. Let's read it together. Hebrews 11, starting in verse 32. And what more can I say? Time is too short for me to tell about Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and the prophets, who by faith conquered kingdoms, administered justice, obtained promises, shut the mouths of lions, quenched the raging of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, gained strength in weakness, became mighty in battle, and put foreign armies to flight. Women received their dead raised to life again. Other people were tortured, not accepting release so that they might gain a better resurrection. Others experienced mockings and scourgings, as well as bonds and imprisonment. They were stoned. They were sawed in two. They died by the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins, in goatskins, destitute, afflicted, and mistreated. The world was not worthy of them. They wandered in deserts and on mountains, hiding in caves and holes in the ground. All these were approved through their faith, but they did not receive what was promised, since God had provided something better for us, so that they would not be made perfect without us. Today, as we continue this series and look at another incredible story of faith, of another incredible, regular human, we're reading about our family. We're reading about part of God's family that we are connected to, and that our faith today in response to Jesus helps perfect the faith story that they began in their life. We're going to be talking about Barak. So let's jump right in. Judges 4, 1 through 3. The Israelites again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord after Ehud had died. So the Lord sold them to King Jabin of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. The commander of his army was Sisera, who lived in Harosheth of the nations. Then the Israelites cried out to the Lord because Jabin had 900 iron chariots and he harshly oppressed them 20 years. People again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. They, like us, prone to wander. Prone to make mistakes, prone to forget what God had done in their lives, did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. And like many great stories of faith, we are beginning here with a pressing and harsh reality. That is, things were bad. This is the baseline that we begin this story of faith. But despite that truth, that this is where it began, we're not going to be talking about that part of it today. We're not going to be talking about the 20 years of suffering that God's people endured because of their sin, because of their wandering, or the ways that the Canaanites subjected them. That's not the point. Instead, this is a story of hope. This is a story of peace. This is not some sort of like, oh, I hope it all works out, hope. Real hope. A God will win sort of hope. I recognize that it's going to be completely and perfectly okay hope. We're going to talk about the way that God's perfect and beautiful plan for our lives refuses to be derailed by our sin, by our confusion, by our reluctance to follow what we are supposed to do. Did you hear that? You can fail and flail, but you cannot stop God's plan. We always have the opportunity to seek repentance and righteousness and to get right back up and recognize that we are still part of God's team. And that regardless of what you or I or any person, principality, nation out there does, God is still going to win. It's simple and it's true. There is no corrupt system, even Satan himself, that has any chance to stop God's kingdom from coming. How outrageously encouraging with any present chaos that we may feel or face. It's like the one line from The Grinch. I like the 64 animated version. He hadn't stopped Christmas from coming. It came. Somehow or other, it came just the same. So, with that clear, let's hop into the story of faith. Judges 4, 4 through 5. Deborah, a prophetess and the wife of Lapidoth, was judging Israel at that time. She would sit under the palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim. I'm sorry. Of Ephraim. And the Israelites went up to her to settle disputes. So here we find Deborah, a judge and a prophet. And to be clear, judges played a very specific role for the Israelite people. They were leaders, not selected by credential or consensus, but they were recognized because of the spiritual leadership that they displayed in front of God's people. Deborah herself had no institutional religious role or credential. She was not a priest. She wasn't even in the family of Levi. She wasn't a Levite. She was a woman in a male-dominated religious system. And guess what? Lead, she did. The people recognized her as an authentic spokesperson of God, a wise and discerning judge capable of settling their disputes. They went up to where she was to learn and heed her advice and to hear God speak to them through her. You know, a few years back, our congregation did some pretty significant work to review the structural and scriptural formation for how we as a community handle like gendered roles within the church, both on paper and in praxis, right? Like, this is what we say and this is what we actually do with those things. I'm incredibly proud that we as a community took great strides at that moment to make sure that we weren't taking scriptures beyond the context that they were supposed to exist in, while also not throwing out clear instructions based on what just might feel right in the present time or in the future. In that process, we recognized across the board that we as a community had been limiting women in their opportunities to fully use the spiritual gifts and talents that God had given them, both for the betterment of the community and the world around us. While we understood how they came to be, that history did not absolve us of the reality that limiting action was wrong and it needed to change. I believe that as a church, we did a great job changing things on paper. But as you and I know, the in praxis is the much more difficult part of any change. As a family, we have a lot more work to do in this area. Difficult times, like all times, but even more than most, require that every member of the body of Christ has been equipped and offered the opportunity to use the spiritual gifts that God has specifically designed for them to use for the edification of the church. And to use them for the transformation of the world around us. In my own life, I bemoan the many times that I have had the opportunity to include women speakers in my lessons, but failed to do so because of my frequent weakness of saying yes to too many things, and thus having an incredibly tightly packed schedule where each thing is then immediately working on the next thing. And so even though I intended, I didn't actually give and offer the chance to effectively include women speakers in what I did, because it wouldn't be fair to ask someone at the last minute to just do this properly. You know what I mean? Like, that's not fair. I'm sorry for this. It's a recognition that this is an area that I can definitely do better in, and we as a community can definitely do better in. I have been so very grateful to hear more from my beloved sisters and mothers in this room and in other rooms over these last couple of years. But honestly, we have more work to do in this area. And I am so grateful for the example of Deborah to remind us of both the value and necessity of such work. In his excellent commentary on Judges, Daniel Block writes, As for Deborah, this remarkable woman is without doubt the most honorable human figure in the book of Judges and one of the most remarkable characters in the entire Old Testament. As the prophet of God in a dark and dismal age, she represents a ray of light and hope. Yahweh is the true hero of the account, but the character and achievements of his agents should not be minimized. In an era of weak men, God raised a woman to serve as a lightning rod against his wrath. The priesthood's silence in the chapter is deafening. But just because they are in spiritual decline does not mean that Yahweh has abandoned his people totally. He still has his representative, specifically in this case, in Deborah. Oh, what encouragement this gives us that God is able to look clearly at a community's needs and give them what needs to be said, to be spoken, what should be loud, and that in any situation that we may find ourselves in this or future year, God is going to continue to be working through the voices of his disciples to lead us towards him. Judges 4, 6 through 8 continues. She summoned Barak, son of. Help me with these names, all right? But Abinoam from Kadesh in Naphtali and said to him, "Hasn't the Lord, the God of Israel, commanded you? Go, deploy the troops on Mount Tabor and take with you 10,000 men from the Naphtalites and the Zebulunites. Then I will lure Sisera, commander of Jabin's army, his chariots and his infantry at the Wadi Kishon to fight against you, and I will hand him over to you." Barak said to her, "If you will go with me, I will go. But if you will not go with me, I will not go." And so, right, here's this important moment. The community has been in subjugation for 20 years, and God has opened the door that they can be saved. And it's Barak's responsibility to save the people. And God has told him this based on how this is phrased. And for some reason, he's reluctant. For some reason, he's not yet having gone. And you know, there's good arguments to be made both for and against this idea that this last sentence is potentially cowardice versus faith. On the cowardly side, it's literally this idea of like, hey, I'm too scared to do it alone. On the faithful side, it's possible to read this text as him recognizing Deborah as a mouthpiece of the Lord and essentially saying, "Yes, God, if you are with me, I am in," type of thing. So it's just important to note that there's not complete clarity at that point. But for whatever reason, we know at this point there has been some sort of reluctance. But Deborah recognizes this and points back to the scriptural truth and what God's will actually is done. And so honestly, when I read the story, I'm gonna pick faithful. Because you know what? God doesn't judge us by our stumbles. He judges us by our salvation. He judges us by what we eventually choose to do to honor and follow him. Barak is honored in the Hall of Faith because despite his initial reluctance, he went. He did what God was calling him to do. Deborah responds, "I will gladly go with you," she said, "but you will receive no honor on the road you are about to take because the Lord will sell Sisera to a woman." So Deborah got up and went with Barak to Kadesh. Barak summoned Zebulun and Naphtali to Kadesh. 10,000 men followed him, and Deborah also went with him. This is an important lesson for us. What do we do when someone in our lives needs true encouragement? Do we wish them warm and well fed? Or do we go with them to the point of where they need to test their faith? You know, there is much to be said about the concept of our faith being our own, right? I think we need those lessons for certain points. We also need the lessons to recognize how deeply interdependent we all are, and that God has put us in one another's lives to be able to stand firm for each other and point to the truth when any one of us is wavering. Because guess what? Everyone in this room is going to waver. And so do unto others what you would like to be done for you. And in those hard times when someone doesn't really want to talk and it is just kind of bristly to be around, but needs love, go through the extra work to give that love. Do we wish them warm and well fed, or do we go to the hard places with them? Do we go gladly? Now, Heber the Kenite had moved away from the Kenites, the sons of Hoab, Moses' father-in-law, and pitched his tent beside the oak tree of Zaananim, which was near Kadesh. What? This is deeply unrelated to the story, right? We're reading, and so far contextually everything makes sense, and we have this random factoid that then we keep going. It's what? There is some foreshadowing here, right? This is going to kind of lead us to the conclusion of the story. But when you're reading, you should be shocked by such a sentence. It's okay. These stories are meant to interact with our hearts and our minds and are sometimes meant to be hilarious and sometimes confusing. Interact with it. This is weird. This is a funny fact that makes no sense in the context of what we just read and what we'll continue to read. Let's continue. It was reported to Sisera that Barak, son of Abinoam, I can say it right, it's just very hard for me, had gone up Mount Tabor. Sisera summoned all his 900 iron chariots and all the troops who were with him from Harosheth and the nations of the Wadi Kishon. Then Deborah said to Barak, "Go, this is the day that the Lord has handed Sisera over to you. Hasn't the Lord gone before you?" So Barak came down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him. But look, who's the main character here? The Lord threw Sisera, all his charioteers, and all his army into a panic before Barak's assault. Sisera left his chariot and fled on foot. Barak pursued the chariots and the army as far as Harosheth of the nations, and the whole army of Sisera fell by the sword. Not a single man was left. Except for one, right? Sisera had already fled. Meanwhile, Sisera had fled on foot to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. Oh, okay. There's the context. There's the confusing piece why it's here. Because there was peace between King Jabin of Hazor and the family of Heber the Kenite. Jael went out to greet Sisera and said to him, "Come in, my lord. Come in with me. Don't be afraid." So he went into the tent, and she covered him with a blanket. He said to her, "Please give me a little water to drink, for I am thirsty." She opened a container of milk, gave him a drink, and covered him again. Then he said to her, "Stand at the entrance to the tent. If a man comes and asks you, 'Is there a man here?' say no." So Sisera does what is pretty reasonable. He goes to a little tent community where he perceives them as allies to his king, which they were. They had an agreement, and says, "Okay, this is where I'm going to find safety." While he was sleeping from exhaustion, Heber's wife Jael took a tent peg, grabbed a hammer, and went silently to Sisera. She hammered the peg into his temple and drove it into the ground, and he died. When Barak arrived in pursuit of Sisera, Jael went out to greet him and said, "Come, and I will show you the man you are looking for." So he went in with her, and there was Sisera lying dead with a tent peg through his temple. And guess what? We have no idea why she did it. Like, this is a significant thing. I'm so sorry. I'm totally off on these slides here. Let's see. I was right. Oh, nice. Okay. Thank you guys for helping me out in the back. I'm just going to stop clicking it. Like, this is a crazy significant thing that just occurred. And the Bible gives us nothing, not a hint. Like, okay, maybe there was an alliance, but they felt wronged in some way, so she was taking upon it herself to fix it. Maybe she's like, well, clearly the Israelites are coming and they're going to be in charge, so I might as well just get on their good side now. Nothing. Not an ounce of information is offered to us to give us a semblance of like, oh yeah, okay, I get it. That makes sense. No, just a tent peg. And now I want to read this quote also from Daniel Block. The narration offers no hint of any spiritual motivation on her part or any concern for Israel. She acts entirely on her own and for her own mysterious reasons. Her actions are not only deviant and violent, but socially revolutionary, challenging prevailing views of female roles in general and the relationship of husband and wife in particular. However, just because the author records her deeds does not mean he approves of them. It simply adds to the mystery of divine providence, demonstrating implicitly what the following verse explicitly affirms. God is able to incorporate the free activities of human beings into his plan for his glory and for the salvation of his people. God gave us free will and somehow is still able to use everything for his glory and for the salvation of his people. He's able to do that for us because he wanted you to have a chance to know him. Because he wanted you to have a chance to know him. Because he thought it so fitting that you would get the opportunity to reach his grace. That an entire history of things happened in your life that seemed like random coincidences to lead you to a place that you might have a chance of knowing him. And he did it because he loves you. Because he cares about you. And it's amazing. Judges 4:23, that day God subdued King Jabin of Canaan before the Israelites. Again, God is the main character here. The power of the Israelites continued to increase against King Jabin of Canaan until they destroyed him. Remarkably, the protagonists in the drama that have riveted our attention since verse 4, have all disappeared. The reader learns hereby that this story is not primarily about Deborah and Barak, or Barak and Sisera, or Sisera and Jael, or Jael and Barak. The author would be disappointed if our analysis ends with these intriguing characters or the dynamics of power and control that play out between them. This is a story about God, who is the real hero, and his people Israel and their enemies, the Canaanites, represented by Jabin, their king. The conclusion reminds the reader that the conflict in the book of Judges is not between patriarchy and egalitarianism, between men and women, or even between Israelite leaders and rulers of the nations. The conflict is between the divine king and the kingdom of light on the one hand, and the forces of the kingdom of darkness on the other. Let's now read the victory song or portions of it. On that day, Deborah and Barak, son of Abinoam, sang, When the leaders lead in Israel, when the people volunteer, blessed be the Lord. Like we've been talking about this entire series, right? There's multiple parts. There's what God does. There's what spiritual authority does. And then there's what we do. And it all works hand in hand to accomplish God's will. Listen, kings, pay attention, princes. I will sing to the Lord. I will sing praise to the Lord God of Israel. Villages were deserted. They were deserted in Israel until I, Deborah, arose, a mother in Israel. Israel chose new gods. Then there was war in the city gates. Not a shield or spear was seen among 40,000 in Israel. The princes of Issachar were there with Deborah. Issachar was with Barak. They were under his leadership in the valley. There was great searching of heart among the clan of Reuben. Why did you sit among the sheep pens, listening to the playing of pipes for the flocks? There was great searching of heart among the clans of Reuben. Gilead remained beyond the Jordan. Dan, why did you linger at the ships? Asher remained at the seashore and stayed in his harbors. Look, God is going to win. He's going to bring about salvation for those that would follow him. He is going to give everyone a chance to know him. And he's going to accomplish that will through people. And if it's not through us, it will be through someone else. So, I must ask you, we must ask ourselves, will it be me? When God shows up at your door with opportunities to heed his call and go and serve and sacrifice, and decade after decade, do what he asks and lay down your life for the good of others, will you respond? Or will you linger with your comfortable life and routines and savings accounts and life traps that cause us issues and other priorities and anything that Satan can use to distract us from doing God's will? Will it be you? Will it be me? Will we be the tribe of Dan in this story? Or we'll be the Zebulun. The people of Zebulun defied death, Naphtali also on the heights of the battlefield. Will it be me? We have to keep asking ourselves this question because there's a lot more work to be done. And God is desperately, today and always, looking for those of us that will respond and do his will. That's it. Will it be you? Kings came and fought. Then the kings of Canaan fought at Taanach by the waters of Megiddo. But they did not plunder the silver. The stars fought from the heavens. The stars fought with Sisera from their pass. The river Kishon swept them away. The ancient river, the river Kishon. March on, my soul, in strength. Lord, may all your enemies perish, as Sisera did. But may those who love him be like the rising sun in its strength, and the land at peace for 40 years. This was a story about peace. This was a story about hope. This was a story of the type of hope that can see past nation states and trials and even death and despair, that can see past subjugations, that can see past our own weaknesses, our own sin, and can see the only true path that this world has ever
ever
God will win. Thank you.